All right, good afternoon. I think we'll go ahead and get started. Make sure you're in the right places. Welcome to Safety Record Keeping for the Craft Brewery with Ken Anderson. My name is Damon Scott. I work for the BA as Technical Brewing Projects Coordinator. Basically, that means I have the pleasure of working with all of our technical committees, safety being one of them. Ken Anderson is on that safety subcommittee. And we have the chair of that committee, Matt Stinchfield, and BA Safety Ambassador in the back there trying to hide under that hat. Just a quick plug, if you go to brewersassociation.org, best practices section, you can find all the resources from our technical committees, especially the free online safety training, the best management practice documents that they've developed. It's open to the public, so even if you are a member, you don't have to log in, go through that trouble. You can just get on the website and access all those great resources. Sorry, of course, my app shut down. Ken Anderson is a VP of Risk Control at USI Insurance Services, a leading middle market property and casualty insurance broker. Ken has a BS in environmental health and safety. As a certified industrial hygienist and certified safety professional, he has been involved in safety and risk control for 30 years. Ken has an extensive background and work experience in manufacturing operations, pharmaceuticals, chemical manufacturing, healthcare, brewing, and food service. And as I mentioned, he's also on the BA Safety Subcommittee. So, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Ken Anderson.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks. I just want to thank you all for being here this afternoon on the last afternoon of the last day. Thanks for your interest in safety and health, though. I think I could safely speak on behalf of the safety subcommittee that, you know, we're heartened to see people interested in keeping their breweries safe, keeping their employees safe. So I really thank you for being here for this presentation. Obviously, a subject like OSHA record keeping is pretty expansive, and in an hour format, it's hard to take a deep dive into any of that. What I'm hoping to accomplish, though, is give you some, point you in the right direction. What kinds of OSHA standards require record keeping? What kind of record keeping should you be considering doing in your brewing? How do you handle an OSHA inspection? Some of those types of things. And OSHA's got some recent changes in requirements for reporting injuries to OSHA. So we'll go through that as well, because I think many employers, not just brewers, but many of the companies I work with still don't know about those requirements. So just a quick look at the agenda. What are some of the things that might trigger an OSHA inspection of your brewery? And that's obviously probably when the record keeping becomes most important, because if they're trying to determine how well you're complying with their standards and regulations, they're going to want to see some evidence of that, right? They're not just going to take our word for it. Obviously, I mentioned the fatality and injury reporting requirements, injury record keeping. So as far as keeping the OSHA 300 form, the 301, 300A, and then we're going to go briefly through some of the OSHA standards at a very high level that might require some written documentation. So what do you think some of the things are that might trigger OSHA to show up at your brewery? Any ideas? Accidents, injuries? Phone call, yeah. Anything else? Hopefully that never happens, but you know, one thing is imminent danger. I wouldn't typically expect that to be a problem at a brewery. This would be, you know, if OSHA's driving around out in public and they're going past a construction site and they see people doing something unsafe, they can stop right there if it looks like it's an imminent danger and initiate an inspection. Obviously, in the case of fatalities or serious injuries, and those requirements did change January of 15 on what you actually have to call OSHA and report. So I want to make sure everybody really understands what those are, because that would potentially trigger an inspection. And many of the companies that I work with that never would have been on OSHA's radar have had visits in the last 6 months to a year because of these new injury reporting requirements. So it is a way you can show up on their radar, unfortunately. Complaints are referrals, right? Disgruntled employee, somebody you terminated, or they're not happy. You know, a lot of times they use OSHA as a stick and call in a complaint. Whether it's valid or not, OSHA still will attempt to investigate whether that's a valid complaint. They have programmed inspections for certain types of industries and also for certain types of hazards, like machine guarding and silica and other things like that. Oh, and then along with complaints, sometimes they'll get referrals. So if you have a serious injury in your brewery and emergency services show up, sometimes those EMTs or firefighters, if they see something they think is really unsafe, might call OSHA on a referral basis, right? So that's another way that you could end up on their radar. And along with a higher potential to maybe have a visit if you have a serious injury or fatality, hopefully that'll never happen, but OSHA increased their penalties in August of this year. They hadn't increased them in a couple decades. So now a serious citation's gone from $7,000 to $12,000 per citation. Willful's up to $125,000, and same with repeated violations. And they're actually going to index their penalties with inflation moving forward. So they're going to have the ability to levy heavier citation penalties. The other thing they'll do, if they're working with an employer that is very intransigent and doesn't want to work with them and willfully disregarding safety, they can even apply these penalties on a per-employee basis. So if we had 10 employees exposed to a confined space hazard and they really wanted to send a message, they could say, we're going to cite you for that serious citation times 10, and now it's a $70,000 penalty. So they do have a stick that they can wield when they feel like employers are not doing the right thing. So how likely is OSHA to show up at your brewery? I did a research. All of OSHA's inspections are actually public information. You can go to the OSHA.gov website, and if you type in the search box, establishment search, that takes you to a website where you can go and search by industry code or by company name or even by state, and you can see, okay, who's been inspected, and when they got inspected, what they get cited for. Okay, so that's a good resource, and since 2010, it's been almost 300 inspections in the brewing industry. Last 2016, there were 46. And then the other thing is, as we mentioned, we'll go into this in more detail, with the serious injury reporting, they also have a database that goes along with that. So all the serious injuries that are called into OSHA go into a database, and you can actually access that. And there were 10 injuries since January of 15 that occurred in breweries, where the brewery actually had to call OSHA and report that injury. I think that's probably underreported. I would suspect there's a lot more injuries that met the threshold of having to call OSHA, but I think a lot of smaller employers still have no clue about that particular requirement to call and notify when your injuries rise to a certain threshold. So I'm sure that, you know, even though there's been 10, there's probably been more injuries that should have been reported to OSHA that weren't because so many companies are still unaware. And then this is just a screen capture off of OSHA's website. I went into that establishment search, pulled up inspections in the brewing industry, that 272 inspections, and this was just a sampling. You can see there's a little bit of everything here. This inspection here was a complaint. This was a planned one. This was a referral from maybe from another agency, and this one was because of an accident. And then over here, you can see how many citations were issued for each of those inspections. And then the other thing is, if you click this hyperlink right here, that takes you to the inspection, so it'll tell you which employer it was, what the initial proposed penalties were, what the settled penalties are, because sometimes you can negotiate those down. And then you can actually even see which specific OSHA standards was OSHA citing that company for. Okay, so good resource if you're curious about, hey, what are the kinds of things breweries are getting cited for? That establishment search page is a good place to go and find out more information about that. So one thing that changed, OSHA's always required that employers, regardless of size, report to them within 8 hours if you have a fatality of an employee. In the past, you also had to report to them within 24 hours if you had three or more employees hospitalized due to a single incident. So a single incident injured three people at the same time, they were hospitalized, you had to call OSHA. That all changed in January of 2015. So now, if you have a single employee that's hospitalized as a result of a work-related injury, you have to call OSHA within 24 hours. So anybody in this group, and you may not want to raise your hand, but has anybody had an injury that hospitalized an employee in the last year? So you have? Yeah. So This is where I say a lot of the smaller companies, employers that I work with that aren't fully familiar with the OSHA requirements, I think aren't aware of some of these reporting requirements, and it also puts them up on the radar. A lot of smaller companies that I work with that probably would have never seen OSHA are getting visits because of serious injuries they have to call in. So if it's hospitalization of one employee, amputation, and that can just be cutting off a fingertip, and loss of an eye. Those are the three triggers for reporting a serious injury. And of course, as we said, fatalities have always been a requirement of OSHA to report. Any questions on that before we move on? The injury reporting requirements? Yeah, go ahead.
So hospitalization, does that mean just being admitted in general?
So if the employee goes to the emergency room, they're treated, they're released, that would be medical treatment, but that wouldn't be hospitalization.
I had something happen where we were admitted, a person was admitted to the hospital, but it was only for like a 4 or 5 hour treatment.
Right.
And we accidentally reported it. It didn't need to be reported.
Right.
And went through that whole thing. So I'd say if anybody has any questions about if you need to report something, just call them and ask them.
But that definition,
I think, was kind of confusing for me.
Yeah, and the other thing is if the employee stays overnight, if they're at the hospital and it's just for observation, in other words, the doctors just want to keep an eye on them, but they're not really doing any treatment,
right. That
doesn't meet the requirement of having to call OSHA and report. That's a good question. Thanks for bringing that up. So provisions that didn't change. If you have a fatality that occurs on a roadway or in public transit, you don't have to call OSHA and report that. So if you have an employee driving to a festival or making a delivery, kegs or whatever, and they get involved in a traffic accident, and they're killed, you don't have to call OSHA on that. Unless it occurs in a highway work zone, construction zone. But other than that, you don't have to. And as we said, if they're just in the hospital for observation only, not treatment, you don't have to call OSHA. You do need to report fatal heart attacks. I had this come up recently with one of my clients. They're a distributor in southern Colorado, and they had an employee servicing draft lines at one of their accounts, and after they were finished, they weren't feeling well. And initial reports are really conflicting when they started coming into the employer, and then the employer called me in a panic, and the customer was saying, well, we think the employee got sprayed in the face with beer line cleaner while he was cleaning the lines. Went out and sat in his car for about 45 minutes, eventually called his supervisor, was taken to the hospital, and died a few hours later. Going through the autopsy and reviewing all the video footage of the client where it happened, had great video back of the house, so we could see everything that happened. It was pretty clear that it wasn't the exposure to the beer line cleaner that caused the problem. It turned out that he had a heart attack, and that was found out during autopsy. But this employer still had to call OSHA because early on, you often don't know why that fatality happened, right? All the information may not yet be available. So they were able to go back and view all that video footage, and you know, the employee put their tools away, they cleaned up, they were obviously not really in any distress, but then the heart attack happened. But in those cases, OSHA will decide whether they're going to investigate or not. So what happened in the case of this employer, I'll head off your question there. What happened in the case of this employer was OSHA called and said, we'd like the results of your investigation. So we want you to do a good incident investigation, what happened, you know, and then share those results with us. They didn't come out and inspect, but they're obviously, it put that client up on the radar, right? So, okay, so how can you report to OSHA? You can call your nearest area office. If you go to the OSHA.gov website, you can look that up by state. They also have a 24-hour OSHA hotline, so those area offices close for business usually around 5 o'clock, but after that there's an 800 number. And you can also go to OSHA.gov. They have a website where you can report injuries there as well. You know, federal OSHA covers about 25 states. The remainder of the states are state plan states. But if you go to the OSHA.gov website, which is a federal OSHA website, it'll still tell you who your contact numbers are if you're in a state plan state. So shouldn't be a problem. Record keeping. So if you have 10, and we'll talk about the forms that you have to keep for injuries. So if you have injuries that rise to a certain threshold, you have to record those on an OSHA injury log. If you have 10 or fewer employees, you don't have to keep that written record of injuries. It's not required by OSHA until you have more than 10 employees. However, that doesn't exempt you from the requirement to report those fatalities, hospitalizations, loss of an eye, or amputation. So it partially exempts you from the record-keeping requirements, but it doesn't exempt you from having to report and notify OSHA of serious injuries. I work with hundreds of different companies, and one of the first things I always do is review their OSHA records for injuries, if they're of a size that requires them to have it. It should be one of the simplest things to do, but it's one of OSHA's most confusing standards. And I see a lot of errors in how this information is recorded, and a lot of companies put too much on their OSHA log. They put every single incident that happened on there, minor cuts and things that don't rise to the level of OSHA recordability. And that can work against you if you ever get inspected, because one of the first things a compliance officer is going to want when he shows up at your facility for an inspection is your injury record-keeping forms. So if you've got a lot of injuries on there that don't belong, they don't rise to the level of what OSHA considers recordable, it can actually make you look worse than you are, right? So we want to make sure what goes on the OSHA log is actually recordable. So there's three forms that go along with OSHA record-keeping. The 300 form, which is just the log of injuries, and we'll show you an example of each form. The 301, which is an injury and illness incident report. In many cases, your state first report of injury of a work comp claim will suffice in place of the OSHA Form 301. And then the 300A is the summary that you have to post every year from February 1st through the end of April. So who has more than 10 employees in their brewery? So quite a few. Out of that same group, who posts their OSHA 300A? So about half, right? So it's a lot of people that still don't really understand all the requirements that go along with this. And as we said, you're not required to keep the paperwork if you have less than 10 employees, the paperwork for injuries. So what needs to be recorded on the OSHA injury forms? Injuries and illnesses that are work-related and meet certain severity criteria. And I always tell people, keep the issue of workers' compensation and OSHA recordability separate. So many employers have the mindset that, well, the employee got cut or they got burned, they went to the clinic, therefore it has to go on our OSHA log. Well, if the treatment that was provided by that clinic falls within OSHA's guidelines for first aid treatments, it doesn't go in your OSHA log. So you really want to make that determination separate, OSHA recordability versus work comp claim. Make that determination separately on whether you need to actually put that on your OSHA log, because we don't want to over-report things that don't belong in there. So what are some of the criteria for recording? Obviously, a fatality, loss of consciousness. If you have a workplace injury that results in days away from work, so the employee gets hurt, the doctor says, hey, you can't work for the next 7 days, that's a recordable injury. That's what we call a lost workday case. Restricted work activity. So the employee maybe works in packaging or in the cellar. They get injured, they go to the doctor. The doctor puts a work restriction on and says, hey, you can't lift more than 5 pounds. Well, a 5-pound lifting restriction is probably outside of what the normal duties are for that job, right? So there's a significant restriction of the employee's normal ability to perform work. So that would be a recordable injury. And then anything that's medical treatment beyond first aid. And over here on the right side is what OSHA considers first aid treatments. I wouldn't worry about writing all these down. The presentations will all be available on the BA website, and there'll be a recording of the presentation, and you'll also be able to look at the slides. But I do want you to know that even if the employee goes to a doctor for treatment, if what the doctor does falls under that list of first aid treatments there, it doesn't have to go in your OSHA log, unless there's another trigger, lost work days or work restrictions. So any questions about that? Anybody?
Yeah, excuse me. So we were talking about, well, at our brewery, we keep a log of basically all injuries and incidents, but that's kept separate from our OSHA logs. Is that totally fine?
That's totally fine, yep. A lot of companies like to just keep a list of everything, right? And I encourage that because you may be capturing first aid or near misses or other minor things that wouldn't go in your OSHA record keeping, but it's useful information to you in the brewery, right? Because then you can see, well, what are the things that are causing us problems? So you don't want to lose the ability to have that information. But you also don't want to make your OSHA forms, your OSHA record keeping, look worse than it should be, right?
But we also just shouldn't volunteer that either if OSHA ever shows up.
I wouldn't.
Don't ever tell them anything they don't ask you for specifically.
Yeah.
The butterfly on the wound coverings, just using that technique would be considered. considered first aid, but if they actually got stitches,
right,
that would be considered.
Sutures are always medical treatment, yeah. Any other questions about that?
Do you have any examples of a work-related illness?
Okay, so that could be, and this is one people miss a lot. If you have somebody that develops carpal tunnel from repetitive motion, OSHA actually considers that an illness, not an injury. What they consider an injury are things that happen right now. So I picked up a bag of green and my back went out. They consider that an injury, where maybe it's repetition, labeling, or something, then that's considered an illness.
Okay.
Or maybe it's inhalation related. They've breathed in something, or noise-induced hearing loss, things like that. Good questions. Good questions. So this is the OSHA form. Oh, do you have another one? No? Okay. So the OSHA 300 form, this is the actual log of injuries. This is where we list the individual injuries. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but because these columns here are pretty self-explanatory. Name of the employee, what's their job title, where did it happen, and what happened. So, you know, employee slipped and fell, or employee burned their arm on a hot pipe, whatever it is, you put a description right there. Where I always see problems on these forms, though, are the four gray columns right there. In these four columns, you put an X under the column that's the worst result of the injury. So if the employee lost 10 work days because they were hurt, you'd put an X under the days away from work column right here. If it was a job restriction, you'd put an X in that column, and if it's an other recordable, no lost work time, no work restrictions, but it was medical treatment beyond first aid, that's what's considered an other recordable, and you'd put a check in that fourth column. So you put a check in one of those columns. Many times employers will put one in each column. If an employee had lost work days and then restricted days, they'll put double checks, and you don't want to do that. And then over here, we're recording the number of days. So if we had an employee that had 10 lost work days, we'd just put that in the first column here, days away from work. And then if they had restricted work days, we put those over here. If they had both, you can put those in. And you cap that at 180 days. You never have to record more than 180 days. And another common question I get is, well, the employee got hurt in December, they're still off work in January, we're into a new year for record keeping, because the OSHA records run January 1st to December 31st, do we have to put that on our new OSHA log? And the answer is no. You entered it in your log for the prior year, and you just take all the days that they lost, put them back in the prior year's log. Any questions about this form? Yeah.
How long do you have to keep your previous year's records?
Keep 5 years' worth of these injury records, yeah. And if you go to OSHA.gov, they have a really nice Excel version of these forms that you can download. The nice thing about the Excel version of the forms is if you fill out these boxes properly, the check in the proper type of injury, and then the days away, and then over here you're recording whether it's an injury, skin, respiratory, illnesses. If you fill that out properly, it'll populate a lot of the information that you need for the annual summary that you have to post. So it's a really good idea to use it because it helps save on record keeping later.
What about if you have multiple locations you have to do?
You have to have a separate OSHA log for each physical location, yes. Yeah. Good question. This is the one I mentioned. Maybe you may not have to keep this form, the 301 form. If your workers' compensation first report of injury for your state captures all the same information. So you could take this form, you could compare it to your first report of injury. If the same information's on there, don't worry about double record keeping. You're going to get that first report of injury back when you report a claim. You can use that in lieu of the 301. And then the other form that you have to post is the 300A. So this has to be posted from February 1st through the end of April every year in the workplace where employees can view it. And as I said, if you fill out the 300 log properly, these fields here will all self-populate. Everything on the left side of the form over here will self-populate from that 300 log of injuries. What you need to make sure you do over here on the right side is, what was our average annual number of employees? What was the total man hours that our employees worked in that calendar year? And then down here at the very bottom, you have to have a principal sign that. So it shouldn't be HR, it shouldn't be somebody working in the cellar unless they're one of the owners. What OSHA really intends is that this be signed, reviewed, and certified by ownership. Okay, so question.
Is it full-time employees?
It's all hours worked by everybody. full and part-time, you have to capture.
So it's the 10 employee?
It would include their employees, part-time, full-time, yeah. Yep.
Is there a distinction between, like, tap room staff and back production area?
No, once you reach that threshold of 10, you're there. Okay. That's an employee, yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Question?
For
this purpose, yes, they would be. And I know in some states under workers' compensation, owners aren't considered employees under work comp in some states, but for purposes of this, yeah.
So I have two partners in a startup, employees, do I have to file this form?
No, because you're less than 10. You didn't meet that threshold. Chuck?
Is it 10 per location or?
10 within the... 10 within the establishment, so the location, yes.
Okay, so if you have multiple locations and each location has less than 10, you don't have to? Or even though it's under the same company?
I would probably keep them.
Just in case.
That's a gray area where they can cause you problems.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so I just wanted to give you a quick overview of these record-keeping documents. We have a lot of other things to cover. Like I said, it's one of their confusing standards. But I think at least you have a sense of what's there, what's required. You can do some more research on your own and dig into whether you need to do it for your brewery. One of the other things that is changing is starting in July of 2017, if you have more than 250 employees, they're going to require you to send these injury records to OSHA. So right now when you fill out your 300 log, your 300A summary, there's no requirement to give that to OSHA. Unless you get a random summary, a random survey from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They take a random sampling of companies in all different industries, and they may ask you for those records. But starting in 2017, if you have more than 250 people, they're going to require that you submit the records electronically. And we're getting, I blacked the screen out with the control, sorry. They haven't even put the website up yet. They're eventually supposed to have a website where you can upload that information. And we're getting closer and closer to July, and I haven't seen it yet. So who knows if it'll even be implemented this year. But keep an eye on that. And there's lots of great materials for compliance assistance. As I said, OSHA.gov, if you just type in the search bar record keeping, there's a tutorial. All the forms are there. There's a lot of FAQs, which are really good if you're trying to determine whether an injury is recordable or not. And I think that'll at least get you started. So we're going to move into more of the record keeping for safety program purposes. Question?
I'm sorry. Going back to the tracking requirements of 2017, are breweries going to be classified as a high risk industry?
The high risk only applies for under 250. So if you have more than 250 employees and you're in an industry required to keep the records, you have to submit them, yes.
But if you have over 250 or if you're in a high risk
industry, right.
Is brewing considered a high risk industry?
It's not. So for a brewery to be required to submit these electronically, they'd have to have over 250. Right. Question?
Will those forms then be public?
It'll all be public record. Yep. Just like that inspection information. If you have an OSHA inspection, that information's out there forever. Anybody can go to OSHA.gov website and look up your brewery and find out what you got cited for. So, yeah, it's all public record. Good question. So we're going to just go through some of the common OSHA standards now that require documentation. Like I said, it's not going to be a very deep dive, but at least you'll have a flavor of what kinds of things you should be considering documenting in your brewery. And there's a difference between documentation and certification. A good way to think about this is, say we've got a forklift, and each day before we let people drive it, they fill out a checklist that they inspected the forklift. That's what I would call documentation, right? They're filling out a checklist that shows it was done. That's documentation. Some of the OSHA standards actually require what's called certification. And that actually means you have to put the date, the time, who was there, and then a responsible person has to sign and say, I certify that this record is complete. So, for example, certain types of trainings and things like that. We'll talk a little bit about maintenance and retention of records, and then we'll see if there's any other questions as we wrap up. You know, some of the older OSHA standards have requirements for doing inspections. An example is the ladder standard. So under the ladder standard, it says that the employer should complete periodic inspections of ladders to make sure they're safe to use. Well, that latter standard has no requirement for documentation. But I would say, what happens if you have an employee on that ladder, dry hopping, going up on the top to dry hop through the manway, falls on the ladder and gets hurt, or the ladder fails and the employee falls? And you have to call that into OSHA and you have an inspection. OSHA didn't require you to have written documentation of that ladder inspection, but do you think it might be helpful at that point to have some written documentation?
They're not going to take your word for it.
They don't take your word for it, right? If there's no evidence of it, they're going to say it didn't happen. Now, many of the newer standards, though, for example, lockout, tagout, have very specific requirements on what OSHA wants. They want a written program. They want to have certification of your procedures. They want to have certification that you're inspecting your lockout, tagout procedures to make sure they still are being implemented properly, and they want you to certify your training. Okay, so the newer standards tend to spell it out, but many of these older standards, a little bit of a gray area for documentation purposes. So why do we want to maintain documents, safety-related documents? What's the purpose? Why do we want to do it?
Have proof that you are doing what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, have evidence. Somebody else over here have something?
I said that's good.
Might save your butt, totally. Yep. If it isn't written, it didn't happen. I've been involved in a lot of OSHA inspections, fatality investigations, serious injury investigations, just general inspections, and they start asking questions. Did you train this person on that? Well, sure we did. Well, let's see the records, okay? And they'll go back and look through everything related to that injury. They might ask for your owner's manuals on your equipment. So maybe it was a palletizer or a bottling line somebody got hurt on, or a forklift, and it's a serious injury. They'll go back to the manufacturer's manual, and they'll say, what did the manufacturer say you should do as far as maintenance and training and inspection of that equipment, okay? So all those types of documents are fair game if they're related to the injury, and they may request those. But it's just evidence of what we did and when we did it and who did it and that we actually did complete it. Go ahead. If it's an OSHA standard, the question was, if you have an employee that's learned a skill over time or hasn't had a formal sit-down training class, do we still need to document that? Is that a good summary? And I would say yes, you'd want to attempt to document that they had the knowledge and skills if it's a standard where OSHA requires training, okay? Just so that you can show that it was done.
So right now, as far as keeping track of what my people like can or can't do,
sure.
If I were to teach my bottle, I would have to do a little more in depth than just saying, like, checking off that box. I would say, I trained in on this day.
Right.
Which is looking for.
They would want to see the content of that training, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe you reviewed on the bottling line, the manual,
sure. How
to use the bottling line, and then you talked about your specific safety procedures for the bottling line in your brewery, right? So you'd want to have some evidence that you covered that material with your employee. Good questions. Any others before we move on? Okay. So how do we know what standards require documentation? Brewing industry falls under OSHA 1910 standards, which are general industry standards. You go to that www.osha.gov. I'll keep pointing you back there. But you can go to that website, and all the OSHA standards are there, whether it's lockout, tagout, confined spaces, forklifts, hazard communication for your chemicals. All the standards are there, and you can read through the standard and see. They actually do have a PDF document on their website that talks about training requirements for OSHA standards. So they've got a nice PDF document that summarizes every OSHA standard that has a training requirement, for example. So that's another place where you can find some good information about what's required. So right here, go to OSHA.gov, go up to the top, click on regulations, and then the search bar up here in the upper right is also a great place to go if you're looking for information on the OSHA website. So some common, this is not an all-encompassing list. I tried to pick some of the common OSHA standards that require some form of documentation. We talked about the injury and illness record keeping already, emergency action and fire plans, hearing conservation, PPE, respiratory protection, confined spaces, lockout, tagout, fire extinguishers. I mean, these are probably all pretty common things you guys have in your breweries, aren't they? Pretty much everybody's got some of these, at least. And that's just a quick high-level overview of some of the ones that have documentation requirements. So, one of the first ones, and many employers don't have this, you're required to have a written emergency evacuation plan. Now, if you have less than 10 employees, the plan doesn't have to be written. You can verbally teach your employees, here's how we sound an alarm if there's a fire and we need to evacuate. Here's where we go to rally to make sure we count noses and we've gotten everybody out of the building. Whatever it is, if you have less than 10 employees, you can actually do that verbally. But I would still make sure you fill out a training document that shows that you trained the people on it, right? So your emergency action plan should be, how do you report emergencies, evacuation procedures? What's our communication process? How do we notify employees of an evacuation? Do we have a PA system? Do we have an alarm system? How do we train employees, and do we hold any drills? This column over here on the right is a related standard. That's the fire prevention standard. Those three things there should actually have bullet points. But if you have fire hazards in your workplace, you're required to have a written program for fire prevention that lists what those hazards are, what the safeguards we have in place are, and then what do we do to maintain those. So this is a real common OSHA standard where I find companies don't have emergency procedures. And along with the evacuation, you should have in there, you know, what do we do in the case of serious injury, medical emergencies? What do we do in severe weather, whatever it is, spills? What do we do in a spill? It's good to have all those emergency procedures pre-planned and written out and train your employees on it. Any questions on that standard? So he's asking, some states require what's called an illness and injury prevention program, which is kind of a safety management system that some states require. And he was asking if he should put this in that document. It wouldn't hurt, right? So your illness and injury prevention plan can be part of your safety manual. Right. And you can have all the other required written programs in there. So, you know, if you want to keep them all in one place, that's fine. And there's certainly no requirement to keep them actually in paper form either. If you want to keep your records electronically, that's fine. They just have to be easily accessible. And if OSHA is requesting them, you have to be able to produce them. Right? So. And in some cases, if an employee is requesting certain information, you have to be able to provide it to the employee. So under noise, who's got a noisy workplace? Any bottling lines, canning lines? Okay. So what kinds of things do you think might have to be documented as part of the noise standard? What's that? Decibel level? Decibel level? Is that what you were going to say? Okay, so the first thing you have to do to determine whether that OSHA noise standard even applies to you or not is, are employees overexposed to noise? The only way to find that out is to do measurements, right? Do some noise measurements and say, are we above or below where OSHA requires us to have a hearing conservation program? You're right, so that exposure assessment is a piece of it. What else might we have to have in the noise standard?
PPE.
What PPE we're going to require, right? What written procedures do we have in place to manage employees' exposures to noise, okay? What about, does anybody that has a high noise area, anybody have their employees get hearing tests? So a couple breweries. If your noise levels are over 85 decibels, the employees are exposed to over 85 decibels for an 8-hour average, you have to do a hearing test when you hire them, and annually. They have to have a hearing test to make sure that their hearing isn't being lost in your workplace. So that'd be another type of record to keep. Okay, so you got some of these. You have to have a written program if your exposures are over 85. You should have documentation that you did measurements so you know whether you're above or below the requirement for that in the OSHA standard. You have to have written records of employee training. And if you're doing audiograms, you want to have all those records available. Any questions about noise? It's very common, and OSHA has been more focused on noise in recent years. Only because if you look at construction and general industry, there's so many millions of employees overexposed to noise in the workplace that it's an area that they're refocusing on and putting a little more attention to. Is your question? It could if the music along with the work environment puts it over 85 decibels. So say you have a canning line and it's normally 82, 83 decibels average for the day. Typically, employees are going to turn the noise up maybe 5 or 6 decibels higher so they can hear it. That might put them over, yes. Could.
Where would you measure that sound at? Like, usually it's within 3 feet of equipment, or is it just anywhere in the entire building?
So the question is, where do you measure the sound? What OSHA's interested in is what's employees' exposure. So the best way to get a sense of that, especially if you have a variable work environment, sometimes it's noisy, sometimes it's not, or the employee goes to different departments, the best way to do that is with a noise dosimeter that the employee wears. It takes noise measurements all day long and gives an average decibel level. Now, a good noise dosimeter is fairly expensive, so if that's something you need to do in your brewery, I'd approach your work comp carrier and see if that's something they can do for you, coming in and doing a noise measurement. Now, as far as just the screening, though, there's actually a few apps on phones that are pretty accurate. You can buy an external microphone for your phone, and if you get a calibrator, you can get pretty close to what's considered a type 2 sound level meter. That's a good screening instrument. You can walk through and just see, do we have any areas that are even over 85? If we don't have any areas over 85 just on a spot measurement basis, then you're not going to be over for an 8-hour average, right? So that's a good screening tool. That'd be a quick down and dirty. Just walk through your brewery, measure some exposures. But you always want to make those measurements where the employees work, kind of in their hearing zone. Best way to do that. Good question. So PPE, what kinds of written documentation might we need for PPE program? Personal protective equipment, safety glasses, gloves, safety shoes or boots.
Hazard assessment.
When and where you wear it, and that's part of the hazard assessment, yeah? What about training records, right? So under the PPE standard, they require that you have a written program. How are we going to implement this standard in our brewery? One of the things almost every employer I work with misses is you have to have a written hazard assessment. You've got to look at each of the jobs in your facility, brewing, canning, warehouse, whatever it is, and then list what are the hazards for those employees. Are they exposed to hot liquids? Are they exposed to noise? Are they exposed to chemicals? Are they exposed to dust? Whatever it is, and you've got to list what those exposures are for each of those job types, and then you have to list what PPE is required for employees working with those hazards. And that needs to be certified. Somebody needs to sign off on that and say, I did a hazard assessment on this date, and here it is, and it's in this document. But that's one that most employers miss, many employers miss, is that initial assessment. Otherwise, how do you know what PPE you're going to require your employees to wear, right? If you haven't gone through a thoughtful process of what do they have to do their job, what are they exposed to, what do we need to do to protect them? Okay, so you got to have that assessment. You have to have a written program. How are we going to implement all of this? Do our written certification of our assessment. And then we've got to prove that we trained employees on it. So you'd want to have a written record that says, on this date, we got all the brewers together, we went through the hazards in the brewery, and we told them what PPE is needed, and then we showed them how to wear the PPE that we're issuing them. How do you know when it's worn out? How do you get a replacement if it breaks or you can't use it anymore? But you got to train your people on all of that. So any questions about that, PPE? Like I said, this is a real quick rip through some of these standards, just so you know some of the things that are required. You can group them in broad categories. So employees that have like exposures, you can group together. Yeah. You could probably do that. If you have standard operating procedures in your brewery for each of the specific tasks employees do, you could probably incorporate this hazard assessment right into the SOP and not have it as a separate document. But if OSHA was asking for that hazard assessment, you'd want to be able to clearly show where that's in the SOP and documented. Yeah. Was there a question all the way in the back?
No, he answered it.
Okay. All right, good. And you have to verify employees understood the training. What's the best way to verify employees understood what you told them?
Test.
Quiz or a test, right? Give them a quick 5-question, 10-question quiz at the end of the training. Have them fill it out. And then review it as a group. If they missed something, you want to know that they didn't get that from the training, right? You want to know that that critical information wasn't retained. You can review it as a group and discuss it, and that way you'll be sure that they know the right answer moving forward. What about respirators? We're going to put people in respirators. What kinds of things do you think we have to do if we're implementing a respirator program? What's that?
How to use it.
So training and how to use it, how to issue it.
Maintenance,
okay. Okay. What else? What else might you want to have?
To identify what exactly you're trying to prevent.
Yeah.
Different masks or different gases or dust.
Right. So he's saying, well, depending on the hazard, we need to know what type of respirator we're going to issue to the employees. Are we protecting them against the dust hazard in milling, or are we protecting them from a chemical hazard somewhere else in the process, right? So to know what kind of respirator you have to issue those employees, you have to do that hazard determination. And if you're trying to determine whether a respirator is required or not, you should probably have some air sampling to help you determine if you're above or below the OSHA limit for that contaminant. Because that's going to be your basis of whether you're going to actually require the respirator or not. If our employees are exposed but it's well below the OSHA limit, you might say, you know what, we don't need a respirator. If you have employees, for example, in milling, if you have dust exposures that don't exceed that OSHA threshold, you may say, well, we're not going to require you to wear a respirator, but maybe you've got an employee that prefers to wear a dust mask when they're doing that work, a filtering face piece respirator. That would fall under voluntary use. You're not protecting them from an overexposure, but the employee chooses to wear it. That actually reduces some of the record keeping and paperwork and admin behind a respirator program. So that's a question. If you read the OSHA, so the question is, people with beards, what about respirators? If you read the OSHA standard, you can't have anything between the seal of the respirator and your face.
Right. Okay.
Can't put it any plainer. I can't wear a respirator right now either. That being said, that would only come into play if the employees are required to wear it because they're overexposed over an OSHA limit. If they're just putting it on because they like it for comfort, I would say that's voluntary use. I wouldn't have a problem with it. Okay. Now, there are respirators that actually provide air to the face. It's called a PAPR, powered air purifying respirator. The employee wears a battery pack and a filter on their belt. There's a hose that comes up to a face-mounted helmet, and it pushes fresh air in constantly. Those kind of respirators, you don't have to worry about the beard because they're a positive pressure. They're constantly pushing air into the respirator. So you don't have to worry about the seal.
If we do require someone to have that respirator,
they have to be clean shaven or you're going to have to come up with something else. Good question. Good, you guys got most of these. Just like the PPE standard, you've got to have that written assessment of hazards. What are the chemicals we're worried about protecting people against? You probably want to do some sampling. Are we above or below the OSHA limit? I wouldn't encourage you to get involved in the expense and headache and hassle of administering a respirator program if the employees aren't overexposed to something, right? Because you don't want to have to worry about the fit testing and the medical screening and all the other things that go along with that. Because employees that are required to wear respirators, you should do medical screening. Make sure that they're physically able to wear a respirator and it won't cause them health problems. And then you want to maintain all your training records. Any questions about respirators? Like I said, this is real quick. Okay, so now we've got our brewing vessels. Whether it's bright tanks, fermenters, mash tun, we got to go in there and do some kind of maintenance or repair or cleaning. That falls under what OSHA calls confined space entry. So what kind of things do you think we might have to do a confined space entry?
Testing.
So testing of the atmosphere before the employees go in, yeah. Is it safe for them to go in that space? What other kind of records do we want to have?
Proof of the watcher when they go in.
Okay, that's part of your process of how you're going to enter, right? Having a watcher to keep an eye on the employee in the confined space, yeah. Signage. Is a permit required or not? Yeah.
Mandatory to put those stickers on confined space.
It depends on what type of space it is and what the hazards are. And confined space is a 2-hour, 4-hour class all on its own, but we'll go into it a little more. Question?
Could I lockout tagout?
Lockout tagout, yeah. Lockout tagout might be part of your entry procedure. You might have a confined space that's permit required. Say you got a mash tun with the power rake in it, right? To go in there, that's considered a permit required confined space because there's a hazard in there. If you can totally remove that hazard before you make entry, you can reclassify that as non-permit required. So we can do lockout tagout like he mentioned. Now there's no power source, and if we can isolate all the other energy for the mash tun, whether that's a steam jacket or other things, then we can go ahead and reclassify from permit required to not permit required and make entry. You still have to follow good, safe practices for doing it, but good. So you have to have a written confined space program. The other thing you have to do is an inventory and classification of all your confined spaces. So you need to go through your brewery and say, okay, I've got 3 fermenters, I've got 2 mash tuns, I've got 10 bright tanks. Whatever confined spaces you have in your brewery, you need to make an inventory listing of those. Just list them right on there what they are, and then you have to classify them. Are they a confined space, or are they a permit-required confined space? So you should have that document for all your confined spaces. And you may have other things. You may have wastewater sumps or utility vaults or other things that employees have to go into that are considered confined spaces. You've got to have that listing.
Could you classify something as never?
If you have permit-required confined spaces, you can say our employees will never make entry. And as long as you post that it's permit-required and you prevent entry and you train everybody that they can't go in there, then you don't have to have the full permit entry process. So maybe you're going to bring a contractor in to do some welding inside to make a repair, but you're not going to let your employees go in. But as a host employer, you want to make sure that that contractor you hire is going to follow all the right precautions. Otherwise, it opens you up to liability if one of their employees gets hurt. Right? Question?
How would you document that water ton if there are rakes and you're going to do the lockout tagout? Would that be written down as permit required, or would that be written down as not?
I would put it in my classification, my inventory listing as permit required.
Okay.
But then part of the entry procedure would be all the different lockout tagouts and that you're going to reclassify it. Or you could even put in your assessment here that's a reclassified space.
Okay.
Make a note of it that way. Question?
This came up in another safety talk earlier. I think it was yesterday. But they had actually mentioned, too, that for a confined space, like we have a couple of grain silos, and nobody goes in there, but they had said, you have to have a procedure because if somebody trespasses and actually is able to get in. Have you ever heard anything like that?
I would secure it so you
can. Kind of surprised, but yeah. You know.
His question was if he has grain silos and the employees never go in there, but trespassers might come on the property and go in, do you have to have a procedure? I would say secure it so they can't. Put a lock on the manhole or the hatch or whatever. Then it's not a problem, but I would still label it as a permit required confined space. Yeah.
OSHA doesn't care about the public.
Yeah, OSHA doesn't really care about the public. They care about employee-employer relationship. That's their total purview. So and then for each of your confined spaces that you have to enter, you should have a written procedure how you make safe entry into that space. How do we lock it out? How do we test the atmosphere? How do we rescue somebody if they become unconscious while they're in there? Should all be part of your procedure. And then we have to have good training and also calibration. So if we're using a 4 gas meter to test that space to make sure the oxygen's okay before employees go in and the CO2 level's okay, wouldn't you want to make sure you have good calibration and bump testing records for that 4 gas meter? Because if a person goes in and is overcome and dies, that's going to be part of the investigation that OSHA gets into. How did you test your meter so you knew it was working properly when you used it? Lockout tagout. You have to have a written program. The one thing most employers miss is if you have a piece of equipment that has more than one source of energy and it's not immediately obvious where you turn that one source of energy off, then you have to have machinery-specific lockout-tagout procedures. So, for example, if we have that mash tun with the power rake and it's got a steam jacket and there's other piping coming in from the hot liquor tank, things like that, lockout tagout's got to cover all those multiple energy sources, right? The steam, the hot water, make sure the valve's locked out, and also the energy source for the rake. But if it's a simple piece of equipment that's got one switch, and it's readily obvious where that piece of equipment is locked out, you don't have to have a full written procedure just for that one piece of equipment. You still have to have a general lockout tagout procedure. You still have to train employees on how to do lockout tagout, but you don't need that machinery specific procedure. Now, I would say if you're looking at a piece of electrical equipment and the shutoff is clear across the room and it's not obvious which switch controls that piece of equipment, I would probably have a written procedure because it's not immediately obvious how you're going to lock that out. The other thing companies miss is you have to inspect each of your written lockout tagout procedures once a year. So that means if that employee is going into that mash tun and you're doing lockout tagout before they make entry, once a year you have to watch them do it and certify that they followed a correct lockout tagout procedure and that the written procedure you have in place is still valid. Maybe you went through a brewery expansion and you brought in additional equipment and you've relocated things onto new circuits and whatnot. That's your time to catch that hey, it's not on that switch anymore. It's on a switch clear over here. We've got to change our written procedure to reflect that. Okay, does that make sense? Understand why they want you to do that annual inspection? And then just like all these other standards, training. How do we document that employees are trained? Okay, fire extinguishers. Typically, you're just going to get the annual inspection. That's going to be documented by your extinguisher contractor, right? They're going to put their tag on it. You are supposed to do a monthly inspection, visual inspection of the extinguisher, make sure it's still charged, make sure it's still where it's supposed to be. There's no requirement for it, but on the back of that tag from your extinguisher provider, whoever does the service, you can initial and date on there that you did it each month. It's a way to document it, but it's not required. Forklifts, written program, proof that you train your operators. What other kind of records might you want in your forklifts, though? Do you think it'd be important to have maintenance records? You might want to make sure you have maintenance records and that you've maintained it according to the manufacturer's recommendations. And I also recommend one of the OSHA requirements in the forklift standard is that each day before somebody uses it for the first time, they're supposed to do an inspection. Well, if you're not using some kind of checklist, how do you prove that that operator used that inspected that forklift? Question?
It's also not just, just for information, it's also not just for each day. If you do multiple shifts,
right.
It's for each shift.
Beginning of each shift, you're correct, yeah. Because if one group of employees are leaving, another group of employees come in, beginning of their shift, they're supposed to inspect that forklift. But if you don't have that checklist, how do you document that you did it? Somebody gets hurt really badly in a forklift accident, OSHA's going to come in and perform an inspection. How are you going to prove that that was done? You're not if you don't have any kind of documentation. You may, over time, develop a... Go ahead, question?
Just a question about the documentation for forklift inspection. We're using a sheet with a web. We basically go through and check it and then put the date.
Uh-huh.
But we wipe it clean at the end of the day and then reuse that same sheet. Should I be keeping a separate sheet that we're saving in forever kind of thing?
It wouldn't be a bad idea, but at least, you know, in the case of that injury, somebody gets hurt on a forklift, you know OSHA's going to come. I would at least make a photocopy of that day's grease board if you're redoing it every day. But I would prefer that you keep a checklist and you have maybe 30 days worth so you can show that it's a regular, ongoing, routine process. Over time, you may have employee exposure records. So maybe people that wear respirators are getting physicals, medical clearance to wear the respirator. Maybe you've got noise monitoring results. Maybe you've got air sampling results. You do have to keep those exposure records as evidence of what employees were exposed to. And any kind of employee medical records you have to keep for the duration of their employment plus 30 years. Great, right? That's a lot of paper if you're a large size employer. If you have an employee that works for less than a year and you have medical records for them, you can give them those medical records when they terminate their employment with you and you don't have to maintain them for 30 years. But that only applies if they're with you a year or less. Bloodborne pathogens, I'm not going to spend time on. That's minimal exposure for a brewery. You should do some basic training with your employees, though. What do I do if my coworker gets cut and they're bleeding all over? They should have just a general awareness of bloodborne pathogen and that what they need to do not to expose themselves if they're going to render first aid, right? But you don't have to have a big, full-blown bloodborne pathogen program unless other triggers are met. Hazard communication. So this is all of the chemicals we use in our facility, right? So as part of hazard communication, we've got to have a list of all the chemicals in our brewery, We've got to have all the containers labeled properly, and where a lot of employers get in trouble is they buy a 5-gallon or 55-gallon container of a chemical, and to use it, they put it in a squirt bottle, and now the squirt bottle is not properly labeled. You can use that squirt bottle as long as you make sure that you label it properly to identify what's in it. The labeling is a big deal. Hazard communication is still, I think, one of OSHA's number one cited violations because it's so easy for them to find any workplace you go into. So you need to have a written program how you're going to implement hazard communication, inventory list of your chemicals, make sure you have all your safety data sheets on site that talk about, you know, how to use each of those chemicals safely, and then you want to have good documentation of training, right, that we've trained our employees the chemicals they use, the hazards of those chemicals, and how we want to handle them to work safely. And material safety data sheets, or safety data sheets now, are considered a record of employee exposure. So OSHA says you have to retain those for 30 years after you stop using the chemical. So I'd suggest if you do keep paper SDSs and you've got things you stop using, take those SDSs out of your book or however else you keep them and put them in an archive file. And just keep them separate so they're not in your working safety data sheets.
Would it be okay to, like, scan those?
Yeah, absolutely.
Keep them digital?
Absolutely, you can keep them digitally. In fact, you can keep them all digitally as long as the employees know how to access them and you've trained them on how to get a hold of a safety data sheet. But yes, you can keep them electronically. Good question. And then just some other general posting requirements. Yeah, does anybody have this poster in their brewery? Kind of the regulatory posting. It's a good one to post. It has wage and hour things. It has, you know, protections for employees that they're allowed to report in, you know, unsafe conditions to OSHA without fear of retaliation. There's a little blurb in there about the noise standard, but it's good to have this poster because it covers a lot of bases. And then the other thing you have to post is that 300A we talked about. If you have more than 10 employees, you've got to post that every year from February 1st through the end of April. Other kinds of documentation you might have at your brewery, you know, disciplinary action. Colorado is probably not 100% unique in this, but in Colorado, if you have a written safety procedure, you've trained all your employees on it, and you have good documentation you've trained them, and you can show that you enforce that safety procedure in your brewery, if an employee gets hurt because they violated your procedure, the work comp carrier can take what's called a safety rule violation. They still get their medical bills paid, but the money they get on lost wages is cut in half because the employer had a procedure, they trained everybody on it, they enforced it, but this employee chose not to follow the procedure. And that's going to vary by state. Every state's different in that. But maybe we want to have documentation of, you know, hey, we wrote somebody up or we had a verbal warning because they violated a safety rule. And that can also help in an OSHA inspection. Employee gets hurt, they're coming in and inspecting, and you show OSHA, we've got a written program, we've trained everybody on it, we have all these great documents, but the employee didn't follow our rules and got hurt. Okay, if you can show you have good documentation of all that, it can help minimize the potential for a citation. They'll take that into consideration. So any kind of records around that can be helpful. Incident investigations. Some of my employers that have had recent inspections because of those serious injury calls to OSHA, OSHA will usually, if they don't come on site to investigate it, they will call and say, hey, we want details on this. What happened? Where did it happen? Send us the result of your investigation and send us corrective actions. So maybe you fix something and you guard it better, you take some pictures, send that into OSHA to show that it's been fixed. Okay, so those kinds of records. Self-inspection audits and corrective actions. Maybe you've got insurance carrier audits. Safety committee meeting minutes and agendas. this is all information that you might have, and I think it can be very helpful. However, I wouldn't necessarily make it available to OSHA because this starts to get outside of some of the things that they can really request. So if they were coming to me saying, I want your insurance carrier's last inspection report with their recommendations, I'd want to have in writing from them exactly why they're requesting it. And I would probably want to have an attorney involved that specializes in OSHA OSHA citations, just to make sure you're not making an admission against interest by giving that to OSHA, because they are somewhat limited in what they can request. Now, if it helps your case, yeah, the insurance company came out, they inspected this hazard, they made a recommendation, and we fixed it, and we've got good documentation that we fixed it, maybe you do want to share it because you can show, hey, we did the right thing, right? Maybe in that case it's okay. Any questions about some of these ancillary other records that you might have? Okay. So sources of help. Threw a lot at you. I told you this is going to be a quick spin through OSHA standards that require documentation. One source is the BMPs from the Safety Subcommittee, the BA. We've got a BMP on confined space entry. There's one on PPE. There's one on forklifts. And we actually have one on how to survive an OSHA inspection. Okay, so there's four BMPs there. They're all accessible on the BA website. You can go to the MBAA website. If you Google MBAA safety program, they actually have written safety program templates that you can download and edit and use for your brewery. The BMPs that the BA has worked on, the safety subcommittee, are kind of high level. So if we're implementing a confined space program for our brewery, the BMP is going to have, here's the framework, here's all the high level things I need to consider when I implement that program for my brewery, where the MBAA safety program templates are more the nuts and bolts of how we're going to do confined space entry in our brewery. Another good website. We talked about OSHA website. Every state has an OSHA consultation program that is separate from enforcement, and it's typically administered through a university, and it's funded by taxpayer dollars. Now, you might say, ooh, geez, I don't want to invite the wolf into the hen house. But the OSHA consultation program is a great way to get some help. If you're a smaller brewer and you don't have the expertise or technical knowledge on how to comply with some of this, they'll come in and work with you for free and help you make sure you're doing the right thing. The only caveat is if they find something that's a hazard, you have to agree to fix it. Okay, so they can never, they won't talk to enforcement. They won't refer an issue to the compliance officers unless, for example, you had an unguarded machine, they pointed it out to you, and you said, go pound sand, we're not going to fix that. Then eventually they could refer it to OSHA, but that's really not their intent. They want to be there to help especially small and mid-sized employers. So that can be a good resource to get some help. Your work comp carrier, okay? So your workers' compensation carrier, even if you're a really small employer, 10 employees, 15 employees or less, you're probably not at a work comp premium size where they're going to send people out to work with you, but they may have good resources available to you. They may have websites with free safety training and streaming videos. They might have sample safety programs. They may have other things that you can avail yourselves of. So typically it's employers that get into larger sizes where they'll come out and do more hands-on, on-site work for you. And then, for example, me, you know, your insurance broker. If your insurance broker is large enough and sophisticated enough to have in-house safety, they can be also another good resource to help you out. But I didn't want to throw all these things at you and not at least point you in the direction of some resources that might help you get your arms around it. So any quick final questions? We've gone over a few minutes, but certainly want to make sure that you have the opportunity to ask what questions you might have. Anything come to mind? Yeah.
Talked about having medical forms on the employees. Where do we find these? Do we initiate these or do you get it from the doctors?
Any kind of medical question was about medical forms and record keeping. They would typically be generated by complying with other OSHA standards. So for example, you were requiring a respirator, so they went to the doctor, had a pulmonary function test, that generated that medical record and you just keep that. It's not a separate form.
Okay.
Or for example, they get that hearing test.
Okay.
That's a medical.
The actual medical evaluation form for a respiratory is available from OSHA, so you would just use that form and get that form in the file.
Okay. Yeah. And typically, if you go to an occupational medicine clinic, typically they'll fill that out.
Okay.
Any other final questions? All right. Well, I know, record keeping is kind of a dry topic, but I think it can help pull your chestnuts out of the fire if you ever get that OSHA inspection, and it can help you make sure you're doing the right thing. So I really appreciate your interest. And thanks for taking the time to come out for the presentation today.